Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, the military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veterans Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now, here's Tom Lyons.
Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we'll meet a Minnesotan who helped pick up the pieces after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and also survived Iwo Jima. And we'll remember a fallen Minnesota National Guard Red Bull soldier. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
This week marks the 72nd anniversary of the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. As Americans, we all share a connection to that day of infamy. But as Minnesotans, we have an additional unique connection. Did you know that Minnesotans fired the first shot against the Japanese at Pearl Harbor on that day? In 1899, the Minnesota legislature authorized the formation of a naval militia. This Minnesota naval militia had chapters in Bemidji, Crosby, Duluth, and Pine City. When war was declared in 1917, the naval militia was mobilized and shipped off to the Philadelphia Naval Yard to become part of the Greater Navy. The St. Paul Naval Unit was sent to San Diego. The ship that the St. Paul Unit would train and fight on was the USS Ward, a World War I-era destroyer. A little over 2 hours before the Japanese attack, the USS Ward, which was on duty providing security outside of Pearl Harbor, saw a submarine following a supply ship into the entrance of Pearl Harbor. The crew, all from Minnesota, fired its first shot at the sub at 6:45 a.m. The first shot missed, but a second shot from her 4-inch gun found the mark. You can see part of this history by visiting the original 4-inch gun which fired the first shot on the grounds of the Veterans Service Building in St. Paul.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.
Joining me now on Minnesota Military Radio is our World War II veteran, Roger Erickson, who was in the Seabees in World War II. Roger, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you. For any of my buddies who might be out there, I was in the 62nd Seabees. Any of you that might hear this, greetings from me, for sure.
Roger, can you tell us where you were on December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese struck Pearl Harbor?
I was in St. Paul, Minnesota. I was still home with my parents near Snellingen University in St. Paul, Minnesota, where my parents' home was.
And Roger, when did you enlist in the United States Navy?
In October of 42. In October of 42, I enlisted, and then I went active duty on December 4th. In 1942.
And Roger, what was your specialty?
My family was in the plumbing and heating business, Frankie Erickson and Sons, right in the Midway District of St. Paul, and my brother. And we had actually 8 or 10 plumbers right at the present time. Two of my grandsons teach plumbing at the Vocational Tech in St. Paul, and I'm very proud of them.
Roger, when you finished your training in Rhode Island, did your entire unit where did you get assigned to?
We went to Port Hueneme and were there for a while. My brother-in-law was 1 week ahead of me in the 60th CB Battalion. He had he was a civil engineer. He was a little bit older than I was. And then we were assigned to, we went over on a beautiful ship. They took us to Hawaii. We landed at Pearl Harbor. It took a few days to get over there.
And Roger, when was that, and what kind of shape was Pearl Harbor in?
They still had the balloons up around the perimeter of the island. Island's about, I think it's about 70 miles around the perimeter of Oahu. And they still had heavy concrete places, bomb shelters out around on the corners. And there was only three hotels on Oahu at the time. And They were wonderful people. They were very friendly and treated us like we were kings. And when we took a small gauge railroad that they hauled sugar cane in and took us up to Red Hill, which is between Pearl Harbor and Honolulu. We were there for 17 months. And our chore there was to rebuild Pearl Harbor and build a lot of new installation. It was a good duty there from the standpoint of the weather and so on. And Honolulu, of course, was a good liberty town for sailors.
We're speaking with Roger Erickson, a member of the United States Navy Seabees in World War II, on Minnesota Military Radio. Roger, can you tell us a few of the projects that you worked on over the 17 months that you were there?
Yeah, we worked on rebuilding all kinds. We built hospitals as the casualties came in from the Pacific. Sometimes we had to work around the clock, and of course we were glad to do it. And we had very good quarters up on the Helawa Mountain there, between Honolulu and Pearl Harbor, and we built tank farms. Housing, barracks. At one point, I remember Roosevelt, and this was headquarters for Nimitz. Admiral Nimitz used to come around, and he wore a pair of shorts, and he had the gold braid, of course. And
Roger, you told me that when you were in Hawaii, you were 20 years old, and you were in charge of building a building. You were the project manager. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you kind of tell it like my dad would tell it. Actually, I was in charge of putting the sprinkler system in the building. And what happened, I was over anxious to be pleasing and working for the Navy. I was proud of it. I knew how to put a sprinkler system in a building. So what we did, we put the pipes rather than weld them. They were threads on the pipes when you put them together. And I thought, well, we'll put them, two of them together to put them, any of you are construction men, you'll know what I'm talking about. We put them together and then we'd lift it two at a time so they'd reach from truss to truss in the ceiling up about 20 feet or whatever it was. But that was a mistake, I found out, because when it got strained on the threads, then they leaked, so then we had to weld them anyway. But I learned. But for a guy 20 years old, they still got the job done, and I'm real thankful that I had the privilege of doing that part for our. When I got home, I remember we were on a church committee, and they were wondering if they should give me some responsibility. I said, well, the Navy gave me authority for a $1 million building, and you're wondering whether I should. Have him be trusted with passing whatever you're talking about here.
Roger, you told us you spent 17 months at Pearl Harbor. When did they tell you you were going to be shipped out, and when did they tell you it was going to be Iwo Jima?
Well, every Christmas I'd write home to my wife. I was newly married 6 months, and then I didn't see my wife for 3 years. And my wife and I wanted to have a baby, and our boy was born, our Steve. And by the way, he's 70 years old this month, my baby boy. And now I kind of lost track of what your question was. Will you throw it at me again?
Sure, Roger. You got a little distracted there. That's good. When did they tell you you were going to be shipped out to Iwo Jima, and when did you find out it was Iwo Jima?
Well, we got orders to go to Maui from Pearl Harbor, and it was Christmas time. That would have been in 44 Christmas, and we thought we were going home, but then they put new insignias and markers on a whole bunch of equipment, and they were retraining us. It was a beautiful place. On Maui, we find out that's where you got retrained, and they had groomed us for 43 days. We're on, We got on USAPAA-195, the Lenaway, and that was the ship. And we had a new chaplain. We had an older gentleman, and we wondered why they had. He was a delightful fellow from out in Rhode Island, and we wondered why they brought us a new chaplain, a younger fellow. But then, sure enough, after 43 days, we're right outside of Iwo Jima, and we got into that. We were there, and we went ashore on the third day.
Roger, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll find out what happened to the Seabees on Iwo Jima in World War II. You're listening to Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking to Roger Erickson, a World War II veteran of the United States Navy Seabees. Roger, when we finished the last segment, you had told us about a pretty cushy assignment at Pearl Harbor, rebuilding Pearl Harbor for 17 months. And then they sent you to Maui, and they put you on a boat, and you didn't know where you were going, did you?
That's correct. We got on USS Lenaway, PAA-195, and we kept going to various places, various islands, for 43 days, I think it was. And we went to Niue Atoka, Kwajalein, Johnston Island. It was about 750 miles between each island, it seems like. And before we knew it, we were way up in the Mariana Islands. And when you have time like that, the guys have little books that they give you that you could trade with other people. You sit on deck, there's nothing to do because you don't really have that much duty. The ship's company does the duty that for the chow and so on. But we went like that for 43 days, and then of course, the scuttlebutt was, where are we going? And we heard that there was I forget the name. Who was that lady that was telling you where you're going? Tokyo Rose. You're talking to the 92-year-old guy here trying to record something.
You're doing great, Roger.
With two really great guys. So then we actually came, we could see Hahajima and Chichijima, and the island looked like a great big ice cream cone sticking out of the ocean. And I think a person on the ocean, you can see approximately 3 miles with the naked eye. And we heard all kinds of bombardment and stuff, and we were right outside of Iwo Jima, and on the third day, then we got to general quarters. When you're with a CB outfit, we were on the ship, and they got us on an LST. We had to climb down a rope ladder, and when we came down the rope ladder, you could hear the bullets. The Japanese bullets sounded different than the American. They were different caliber, I think. Or 25 caliber or something, but they were hitting on the side. You could feel the bullets hitting on, hear them, and then you could feel them on your clothes. And when you're going to go in an invasion like that, they dip your clothes in some retardant so that we were going to sleep. And we didn't know it at the time, but we were 43 days in foxholes there. We slept under the ground, and it was volcanic ash. We went in on the third day. Then on a Sunday night, we got the orders to disembark. I never forget to this day. I hate the sound of the executive officers when somebody makes a loud sound and gives you orders or instruction on a loudspeaker, because you'd be down in the hold and all of a sudden you're sleeping sound. Now hear this, and then they prepared to disembark, and it's kind of an eerie feeling. Then the enemy got a bead on us, so then we had to climb up the rope. Now, it was easy enough to go down a rope with a full pack, had a rifle, and I had my father-in-law had been in World War I, and he had a real heavy knife he had given me, which I had on the side that he had made for me from World War War One, and so. But I remember going. We had to get back up on the ship because they had a bead on us, and it would have been a disaster for us. But we were able to get up. I remember I only weighed 137 pounds at the time. I was 6 foot tall, but then the first night, it was a Sunday. It was the 19th of February in 45 that we landed. That was D-Day, and this was 3 days into it. And we had watched the whole thing happening. It was like Thrill Day at the State Fair. There was all kinds of bombs and things. A 16-inch shell makes a hole about 16 feet deep, kind of a shaped like a funnel. But then the first night we were in the foxhole, they blew up an ammunition dump right just a little bit of ways away from us. So, of course, when we woke up in the morning, then we got orders to move to higher ground. And thank goodness they had picked up the CBs. Our designated compound was to go up to a higher point, which we did. But we got pinned down a couple of times on the way up there.
We're speaking with Roger Erickson, a veteran of World War II, about his experience on Iwo Jima on Minnesota Military Radio. Roger, your primary job there was to build the airfields. Can you tell us about that, how long you were there?
Yeah, I drove a 10-ton truck. They had the GMC trucks, 10-ton trucks. And a fellow went with me for a few hours in the morning. You had to triple clutch them, and there was no top on them. And we had to work. Sometimes we worked many really long hours, 10 hours every day. And then eventually we got lights. And I remember one time when I'm driving, one of the enemy jumped up on the running board, and I had to take the butt of my rifle and knock him off my running board when I'm driving up to have when we were building the airfield. And then one day we got orders I wasn't driving the truck, then we had to pick up shrapnel, and I was behind. This was when there was still a lot of enemy fire there. We picked up shrapnel. We had a magnet on the back of the truck, and immediately in front of me it hit a bomb, and the whole thing blew blew it to smithereens, the whole magnet. It was really something. We were so lucky. I have a little foreword here that's in my book that was given to us by our battalion officers, and it kind of explains what we did at Pearl Harbor. I'd like to read that if it's okay with you. The battalion arrived at Pearl Harbor at March 29, 1943. Remember, Pearl Harbor had become the battle cry for all Americans in the Pacific. Our Marines had turned the tide on the Japanese offensive at Guadalcanal, and the enemy had begun to feel the blows struck from Anderson Field built by the Seabees. The Navy had begun to marshal her fast-growing forces at Pearl Harbor. Men, material, and ships required new barracks, warehouses, ship repair facility. The 62nd Battalion was the first to take over from the contractors. Incidentally, when you are going to have a meal in the Navy, you have trays, and you go through a line. The contractors, you sat down at a table, family style, but that didn't work when we took over from the contractors, because all you did was sit there and everybody was hollering, pass the potatoes or pass the meat. Nobody got a chance to eat. Pearl Harbor and our officers and men carried through their jobs with the true CB spirit and ingenuity. Among the vital and urgent projects, we completed a submarine base extension, a Wapiao Point amphibious repair service, housing and advanced base equipment. As the Pacific War moved into full-scale offensive, our battalion was assigned to the Western Pacific. As soon as the southern field was operational at Iwo Jima, the 62nd was ordered to the central airfield. Both jobs were started under enemy fire and mortar fire. The book is a history of our battalion, a battalion in which we can be well pride. take well pride, is a record of your of our experience, both the hardships and pleasures made your our part of the winning of the Pacific in the war.
When we come back, we'll remember a fallen Minnesota National Guard Red Bull soldier. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to remember a fallen Minnesota National Guard Red Bull soldier. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shalito.
December 7th marks the 72nd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the veterans community gathered yesterday to honor and remember this war, those who fought, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice. It was humbling to be in the presence of Pearl Harbor survivors that were in attendance, and I was reminded of how few remain with us today. On this day, 27 years ago, President Roosevelt delivered a speech to Congress describing the previous day as a day which will live in infamy. Each and every day I am reminded of the sacrifices our Pearl Harbor veterans made as I see the 50 caliber gun from the USS Ward that sits just west of the Veterans Service Building here in St. Paul. We honor and remember our heroes who are with us today and those who have passed.
Thank you, Commissioner Shalito. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me now is Ken Drevnik, the father of one of our Minnesota National Guard Red Bull soldiers. Ken, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Ken, I understand that you're retired now, but you were a Minnesota State Trooper for a few years.
Yes, that's correct. I was a State Trooper for 30 years, so I retired in 2009 in March.
That's quite a few years on the road. You must put on quite a few miles.
Oh, yeah. We went through a lot of different cars.
Ken, we want to talk today about your son, who was a member of the Minnesota National Guard and part of the legendary Red Bulls. Can you tell me, when did you discover that he wanted to go into the military?
It was in 2005 he joined, actually. And it was kind of a thing. It was in the evening that Dan would always tell me where he's going at night. And him and a friend were in the house, and he kind of came upstairs and mumbled something. And I says, "Where are you going?" And he kind of mumbled under his breath. And I go, "Wait a minute, where are you going?" He says, "I'm going to meet my recruiter." And I go, "Whoa, come here, sit down for a little bit." And so we had a nice long talk. And he had made up his mind that this is something he needed to do. He told me that moment that he was walking crooked lines, and he needed to straighten himself out, and he needed to get on the right track, and he thought the military could do it, and he was excited to join.
So this was a big surprise for you?
It was a very big surprise. He didn't talk to me about it up until that point, and then he was just gung-ho. He really had an ambition to do it.
I understand you and he spent quite a bit of time together doing some racing?
That's correct. We spent the summer at the racetrack from April till October, actually, and we'd run the race car, and he ran it a few times. He'd run his own, and we'd go all over the upper Midwest here at different racetracks.
So you were pretty close.
Dan and I were probably as close as you can get, father and son, you know, and he was the type of person that we could be out in the garage working on something, and his buddies would come over, and there'd be 10 of them standing around, and he'd tell me where he's going. He'd come over and give me a hug, say, "I love you," and he'd be off with his friends. He wasn't afraid to show that to me. We were very close.
And yet he surprised you by telling you he was going to go sign up for the Minnesota National Guard.
That was one of his big surprises. That's right.
Well, how did he like basic training?
You know, like normal, first couple weeks of basic training, he hated it. He had an opportunity to call home, and you could hear in his voice that it's like, "Get me out of here." And then they allowed him to start writing his letters. And I was reading his letters that he'd sent home, and I swear that his drill sergeant was making him write letters because he started talking about having fun, and he liked his drill sergeant, and they're doing all these cool things, and he talked, you know, he liked cadence, and he'd write all about that stuff. So he was actually enjoying himself.
I don't remember having any fun in basic training, but okay, if he said he had fun, we'll believe him. So did he have to go to school then? How long was he in the Guard before he was deployed?
He joined the Guard in 2005. He went on a split unit or a split entry where he went to basic 1 year in the summer, and then they had him up at Camp Ripley, and then in 2006 he went for his advanced individual training. And then came 2009, and they were told they were going to be deployed to Iraq.
And he was a member of the military police?
Yes, he was an MP with the Stillwater unit, and then they were the MP unit for the 34th Infantry Division. So when the Infantry Division out of Rosemont went, they pulled, I believe it was 158 MPs out of the Stillwater unit they went with.
And I understand he was going to school to go into law enforcement.
Yes, he was. He had a dream that he wanted to become a police officer. And so he was actually going to school. At the time, he was going to Century College, and he'd work. He worked full-time. He also did a part-time job, went to school, and was in the National Guard. So he was constantly going. We're proud of him.
He was going to follow Dad and go into law enforcement.
That's what his dream was, and I was happy to have it. I was glad to see him do it.
We're speaking with Ken Drevnik on Minnesota Military Radio. So, Ken, he was deployed over to Iraq, and they had a little trouble one day. Apparently, they were taking rockets on a semi-regular basis, and something happened on July 16th.
Yes. Dan was deployed. It was March 2nd of 2009, and he came home back on his leave end of June and the very beginning of July. And he went back, and they were getting ready for a mission. In fact, they were kind of policing up the area. They were kind of waiting to go, and they didn't have any of their outer flak stuff on it, not the flak vest or any of their
protective gear
on it yet. And a low-flying rocket came in, and when the air raid sirens went off, the rocket hit. And on the 16th, it was at 9:15 in the evening that three of the National Guard men were killed. Dan was killed, and then Carlos Wilcox was killed, and then James Wordish also. Dan ended up, he survived till 3 minutes after midnight, so his actual KIA date is the 17th.
I'm reading from an article here, but the Red Bulls say, we lost three men, we lost three soldiers, we lost three Red Bulls. And all three of those young men were highly thought of in the unit.
They were a team, and they all worked as a team, you know, all of them. And we've gotten to know several of them now, and they're all good guys.
Ken, I need to ask you, how did you find out? How were you notified?
There was a knock on the door. You know, we were up early. I was, you know, we were milling around the house a little bit. It was early, though, and it was 5 o'clock, exactly 5 o'clock in the morning. The doorbell, the knock came on the door, and I went down first because it was unusual, 5 o'clock in the morning, and I peeked out the window, and I could see two uniformed officers there, and they were dressed in their Class A finest uniforms, and I knew. You can't not know. I knew right away that Dan had been killed. They weren't going to come and tell me that he broke a toe.
Yeah, the message that no parent ever wants to receive, but I'm sure when you looked out that window, you did know, and they brought the news as best they could. Did you tell me that they went to each of the three houses at the same time?
Yes, they did. All three soldiers that were killed together, their casualty assistance officer and the chaplain, they coordinated, and at 5 o'clock, all three teams, they were knocking on the doors. James Wordish was Olivia, and then Carlos was from Cottage Grove. So they were in contact, and they all did it exactly at the same time. So to kind of protect us, we invited them in, our casualty assistance officer, who we got to know very well after that. He was the one that actually stood there and told us that Dan had been killed. And it was actually tough to see him to get out the words, but we had to hear it.
It had to be a struggle for him, too. He didn't want to tell you any bad news, but that's what he was there for.
That's right. In later times, it was probably one of his worst jobs, but he said that I'll do it again because that saves somebody else from doing it.
Good attitude. Ken, we're going to have to take a break here in a minute, but you've found a way to turn this into something positive, haven't you?
Yes. We have a scholarship program now, the Daniel Drevnik Memorial Fund, where we give scholarships to our soldiers and veterans who are going to school for law enforcement.
Ken, we're going to take a short break. We're speaking with Ken Drevnik, father of Daniel Drevnik, who we lost on July 16th, part of the Minnesota National Guard Red Bulls. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this scholarship program. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking to Ken Drevnik, the Gold Star father of Daniel Drevnik, who we lost. A Red Bull soldier was lost on July 16th, 2009, in Iraq. Ken, where did you come up with the idea for a scholarship? Where did you had to process the fact that you lost your son, but now you've turned it into something really positive? How did you arrive at that?
We wanted to continue Dan's legacy, and we wanted to continue to be introducing him to new people all the time. We just didn't want that one fateful day just to end everything. People say they'll remember, but we wanted to make sure they can remember, and we wanted to help our veterans returning, our soldiers. That Dan wanted to be in law enforcement, so he decided, hey, let's do a scholarship program, and for people who are going to law enforcement school. And then we came up with a name, Hero at Home. These are our heroes. Our soldiers returning, our current military people that volunteer like this are our heroes. Our civilian law enforcement are also our heroes. So we named it Hero at Home. And so many of our military personnel right now, especially the MP guys, they want to be police officers, but they need some help. And we designed a scholarship program that can give them assistance. It's not tied to a school. So if they need child support to continue and to keep them in school, we can provide some financial assistance for them.
So you decided to raise some money and start handing out $1,000 scholarships.
That's correct. And we went ahead and did it. We applied to the IRS. We got our 501c3, so we are a nonprofit organization now. And we just gave out 6 more scholarships last week. And so far now, we have given out 21 scholarships.
The 21 members, service members that want to go into law enforcement have been the beneficiaries of $1,000 scholarships in your son's name.
That's correct.
What a fantastic thing to do, Ken.
Thank you.
The website, once again, is heroathome.org. We'll have a link to it on our Minnesota Military Radio Facebook page. Ken, so tell me, you've got an event coming up in June.
Yes. As our fundraiser to get funds to give scholarships, we've been putting on a fishing tournament. This will be our second annual. It's not some small tournament. We've turned this into quite a big event. We have pro anglers fishing. We have our next-door neighbor fishing. And this year, again, we'll be up on Leech Lake, June 21st and 22nd. And all of it is to provide and to raise scholarship money. But we also do something a little special for our soldiers and our veterans. We invite them, come up for the weekend, come stay at the casino, Northern Lights Casino. We'll provide for their Friday and Saturday night stay. They get the banquet dinner, and on Saturday we're going to send them out on our tournament boats, and they get to go fish, have fun for the day. Our anglers love this, and we've had great feedback. It turned out to be just a great weekend.
So that's coming up June 21st and 22nd, Leech Lake. And you want to invite all of our veterans, anyone, to come on up and go fishing. It's going to be walleye and bass fishing tournament.
That's right. It's a split walleye, largemouth bass. All the information is on our website about it. They can enter it, or they just come have fun.
And on the proceeds of the tournament then go for more scholarships for more veterans that want to go into law enforcement.
Correct. All the funds raised, and we guarantee 100% of our funds raised go into scholarships.
So this is the second year of this event.
Correct.
How many people were fishing last year?
We had 37 teams fishing, and then we had several veterans participating in the fun day. We fed 130 at the banquet.
And how many do you want this year, Ken?
We're opening it up to 100 teams, so we're shooting for it.
Two anglers per team, so you want 200 people to come up and go fishing.
And that's just our paid anglers, and we've got to get our veterans to come up. And if they want to go on the water, and some of these young guys, they'll appreciate these bass boats. They go.
We're just about out of time, but I have to ask you. You said you just gave out 6 NOR scholarships.
Yes.
How'd you feel when you gave out the checks?
It's fantastic. It makes us feel good. My wife and I, you know, it brings tears to our eyes. And this year, this last time, we did a husband and wife team. Both were in the military. Both of them are going to school for law enforcement. So this was a husband and wife team that we really could help.
So we want our veterans and anyone listening to go to heroathome.org, get more information on the tournament, come on up and go fishing. And you're also looking for some more veterans that might want to get a scholarship.
Oh, yes. You can apply online, and all the requirements are on there. You can read about it. Come apply. And we also won't kick away any donors if there are any out there.
All right, Ken, I want to thank you much for sharing your story today and joining us on Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you for having us on.
This is Ken Drevnik, and the website once again is heroathome.org. Joining me now is Todd Kubinski, who is the Scott County Veteran Service Officer and a past president of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. Scott, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Now, I know you've got some exciting news for us today. What's going to happen? Something going to happen down in Scott County?
Absolutely. We just found out about a week and a half ago that the VA is going to be putting a community-based outpatient clinic in Shakopee, Minnesota. We're one of two. The other one's going to be down in Albert Lea. And we're really excited for the opportunity to be able to have that health care right in our own community.
Todd, is that going to be similar to the one that they put in up at Ramsey, or not that complete?
It's going to be similar. They won't build a new building. It's going to be an existing mall on the west side of town called the Town Square Mall. They will handle approximately 3,500 patients, and they will also provide primary care, mental health care, and podiatry initially.
So all your veterans south of the river aren't going to have to come north anymore.
That is correct. They will still have to go to the VA Medical Center in Minneapolis for their specialty care, but for their primary care, they'll be able to go right there in Shakopee.
Now, how are they going to be able to find out if they can go to the Shakopee Clinic?
Well, that's going to be pretty simple. Right now, they're in the process of remodeling the building. Valor Healthcare is the company that won the bid. It's a contract bid process. They've have other CBOCs in the country that they work, and they're very knowledgeable on what to do with that. They anticipate an opening sometime at the end of June, first part of July, but with anything involved with the government, that remains to be seen. However, we are going to be notified when the veterans can go ahead and switch their primary care from the medical center in Minneapolis to the community-based outpatient clinic in Shakopee, and we'll get that word out.
So if veterans are interested in going to that new clinic in Shakopee, as usual, they should check in with their county veteran service officer.
Absolutely, and I've been told by the VA Medical Center personnel that all they'll have to do when the time is right is call down and request to have their primary care transferred to the new community-based outpatient clinic. Shouldn't have to fill out any more forms or anything.
Are they going to be able to do that online through the MyHealth?
I don't believe so. I think it has to be done through a phone call because they'll have to talk to the patient access center, and they'll make sure that they get those records transferred over.
And Todd, you were telling me that there's some new insurance available too?
Yes, about the same time, and none of us knew it was coming, so we were pretty excited about it. The VA is doing a 3-year pilot project where anybody who's got primary care at the VA, regardless of the amount of service connection they have, or any family member who is receiving CHAMP VA medical benefits, will now be able to purchase dental insurance from either MetLife or Delta Dental. Premiums for a single person range anywhere from $7 to $50 a month, depending on the plan they choose. And all they have to do is contact either MetLife or Delta Dental, tell them that they're a veteran receiving care at the VA or they're on CHAMP VA, and they'll go over the plans with them and get them signed up. So we're really excited about that.
So pretty good coverage at a reasonable amount for a fee.
Yeah, I believe so. We have Delta Dental at the county where I work, and we seem to be very happy with it. So I encourage everybody to get – all you have to do is call them directly, let them know that you have primary care, and that's available as of right now.
Okay, Todd, last question. How's the claims backlog doing in Minnesota?
it's still there. They say that they've decreased the backlog nationwide by 34%. I would venture to say that the regional office in St. Paul is responsible for most of that cleanup on that backlog. Minnesota veterans still are being pushed back to help the rest of the country get caught up. We made our concerns known to our elected officials about it, and hopefully they'll be able to rectify that soon.
And Todd, lastly, what's your best advice to Minnesota veterans?
Every veteran should bring in their original DD-214 to their county office and get it recorded. You have the only one true copy of that document. And at a minimum, go in and see your county veteran service officer, even if it's just a chat, and find out what's available to you.
Todd, thanks for joining us again today on Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate it.
That was Todd Kubinski, our Scott County Veteran Service Officer. We're just about out of time. If you have a mailbag question or a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to address, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com and click on Contact Us to send us a note. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Roger Erickson, Ken Drevnik, Todd Kubinski, Commissioner Larry Shelato, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we take to the skies with Minnesota's 133rd Airlift Wing and discuss an organization dedicated to our combat wounded veterans. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to Minnesota Military Radio with Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition firm. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Podcasts of the show are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.